if you spend your entire life staring out at a world which is systematically depriving very large percentages of people of what most of us would consider to be the basics, and staring out at a world in which the dominant species is systematically undermining the life support systems on which we depend, you are bound to get just a tiny bit depressed every now and then. So the essence of this kind of work, and I suppose that is what I want to try and deal with today, the essence is how does one maintain a sense of sufficient optimism in the face of adversity to go on being able to do work of this kind? That's a big challenge for me. I've been at it for a very long time, more than 35 years now. Not quite sure I could do anything else at this stage of my life. Spent a very happy 7 years with Friends of the Earth, I'm delighted to say. And now a very happy 10 years, 12 years with Forum for the Future. Interestingly enough, and I may reflect on this a little bit later, both organizations were equally difficult to expose to what I might describe as a spiritual perspective. And certainly at Friends of the Earth, which was then, it may be different now, I never like to make judgments about organizations once left, but the time when I was there, 1984 to 1991, it was a fiercely secular, I would say atheistic, organization that was quite uncomfortable with the idea that there was any dimension beyond the science and political rationality that we brought to bear on our lobbying and empowerment processes. And that taught me a lot. I have to admit, that was quite a difficult moment for me, because it was the first time, I suppose, organizationally speaking, as I was in the Green Party before that, which isn't really organizationally speaking in the same place, okay? It was the first time, organizationally speaking, when I understood some of the institutional hostility to drawing on deeper sources of insight, wisdom, and inspiration to make it possible to do the work that we have to do. So that was quite tough. However, I'm glad you've been introduced to me as someone with a sense of humor, because I'm not sure you're going to get a lot of it this afternoon, I'm sorry to say. Indeed, you'll probably get much more of me as a sort of finger-wagging moralist and someone who is concerned about spirituality as part of the destiny of humankind. But that may all sit a little uncomfortably with where you are in your post-prandial state. But it's fun to be here for me. Most of the work that I do today with the Sustainable Development Commission, which of course is work I share with Tim Jackson, who you heard from this morning. Delighted that Tim is able to stay this afternoon. That's very nice. Most of the work that I do at the SDC, and indeed in Forum for the Future, is very applied. And it's all about trying to persuade people that it is in their own self-interest to get on and make a better job of managing the work. In the work that we do with the business community, for instance, in Forum of the Future, it goes under the heading of the business case for sustainable development. The implication of that bit of phraseology is don't worry about the moral case. In fact, don't even bother to ask yourself the question whether there is a moral case for sustainable development. Because what we bring you is this wonderful comfort and reassurance that getting good at this stuff will work for you, your company, your employees, and most importantly, your shareholders. So it's a kind of get-out clause for those who are uncomfortable being reminded of moral obligation. And morality and commerciality still sit very uncomfortably together in the world today. Now, that's not true of all the individuals we work with. There are many individuals in the companies which we have as partners who are intently focused on moral and ethical concerns about their role in the world today. But I'm talking now about their organizations, the persona of the companies for which they work. And at that level, when you're talking about the corporate body itself, not the individuals in it, it's extremely difficult to bring a moral case to bear on what it is that they have to do. Because by far, the most powerful, the driving imperative in their life is to make sure that they are doing the right thing by way of their fiduciary duties for their shareholders. So it can be, it really can be very, very tough. Okay, so my starting point for this, and thank you for the exercise before, because It sort of reminds me about what our ambition level is for a better world. And yes, I do subscribe to the view that a better world is still available to us. I'll come on and ask you the question in a minute, how much longer it's going to be available to us, but I think it still is at the moment. But what is the ambition level? Is it anything other than a better world for every single human being on it? Is it anything less than a better world for most of the life forms with which we share it? Where do you draw the boundary condition about the good life for you personally, for your fellow human beings, for other life forms, and so on? And for me, it is very simple. It has to be for the whole of humankind. It isn't possible, morally or pragmatically, to talk about creating a sustainable future for a segment of humankind. For the lucky 1 billion, if you like, who live like we do today, or perhaps the lucky 2 billion who live like we do today in a few more years. It isn't possible to do that any longer for reasons that I'll come on and explain. Now, because I want to talk mostly this afternoon about the spiritual dimension of some of this, I'm not going to indulge myself or depress you by a great long litany of all the dreadful things that we are doing to each other or to the planet. But I just want to touch on the one thing that does seem to be changing the tenor of the debate today, that has forced it much higher and faster up the political agenda than any other environmental issue I can think of, going back 35 or 40 years, and that, of course, is climate change. And the reason for that is really very interesting, because for the first time, what might usually be described as, quotes, an environmental issue, quotes, that's how things are often pigeonhole, okay, an environmental issue, is suddenly seen to be much, much bigger than that characterization would tell you, and much bigger than most of the challenges and dilemmas that we face in the world today. Sir David Miliband, our outgoing Secretary of State for DEFRA, before he became Foreign Secretary, was very keen to stop anybody in DEFRA ever talking about climate change as an environmental problem. And the reason for that was that he wanted to get them into the bit of the political space that says this is in fact about the future of society and about completely reconceptualizing the kind of economy that we need in the future to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. Now, I don't know where you are on climate change personally. You read all this stuff. You're about to, later this evening, for those who haven't already seen it, to enjoy the experience of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, which is a splendid documentary film, really, really good, really helpful. It has been immensely influential in changing the minds of a very large number of people. And I personally have assisted two chief executives out of an auditorium, having just watched An Inconvenient Truth, one of whom carefully wiping the tears out of his eyes, and the other saying, "Oh God, Jonathan, I've got it now. You've been banging on me for the last 20 years. Now I understand." Which is a sort of bit of a double-edged comment, I have to admit. But still, it's been astonishing. And you'll notice at the end of that film, he doesn't give a lot of space for the solutions to the problems. He sort of leaves it open-ended, but he does imply that we've still got time to do what we need to do to avoid the worst consequences of what scientists call runaway climate change, a process of changes in climate systems which we wouldn't be able to do anything about even if we wanted to. Now, this is a very lively debate in the scientific community. There are some scientists who think we've got a lot of time to get it sorted. Not many, but there are some, and who actually think that the evidence to date gives us a sort of window of time of about 20 to 30 years to make the necessary changes to decarbonize, take the carbon out of our society. And there are a whole host of scientists who think exactly the opposite, who think we've either got very, very little time indeed, or, especially if you subscribe to the views of the redoubtable Jim Lovelock, no time at all, because it is already too late. Jim Lovelock is firmly convinced that we have already crossed that threshold. We've put enough warming into the atmosphere to precipitate natural feedback loops in the system. For instance, to cause the permafrost across the whole of Siberia to melt so fast that all the methane trapped beneath it is released into the atmosphere. Methane is a much more powerful gas than CO2, 21 times more powerful than CO2, and if indeed we've put enough warming up there to cause that change in that natural system, then you can begin to see how these systems could begin to run away, even if we wanted to do something about it. And in his most apocalyptic moments, Jim will stand in front of an audience like this and say, look, you're all wonderfully good people, I can tell just by looking out at you. You're here after all, you must be wonderfully good to be spending an afternoon like this doing this kind of stuff. But I want to just let you know, in the interest of good science, that it doesn't really matter what you do, what anyone else does in the world today, because even if we stop burning all fossil fuels tomorrow, patent impossibility, it would still be too late. And we are therefore on our way to this extraordinary process whereby the planet will take over the consequences of what we have done to it so far. I.e., in his view, we've crossed that threshold, so much so that we've lost the ability to command our own destiny as a species. Now that's an interesting philosophical conundrum, isn't it? It's also quite an interesting conundrum to those who subscribe to a formal set of religious precepts, because it isn't really part of the deal, if you read carefully in any religious text, that in fact our destiny as a species might have nothing to do with us or indeed our God, but everything to do with the natural systems of which we are still an embedded, inextricably embedded part. So I don't know where you are on this debate. I sort of hope you're not with Jim Lovelock, because I don't know quite how you cheer yourself up if you were in the Jim Lovelock camp. He's a bit like Martin Luther, who on one occasion, when he was asked what he would do if he was condemned to death for his religious heresies, he'd say, I would get up in the morning and I would plant a tree. I never really got Luther as a kind of tree hugger of that kind, but nonetheless, I suppose Jim Lovelock does exactly the same. He gets up every morning, and he does, literally, plant trees almost every day of his life. But it's a kind of privatized optimism. It doesn't send out a lot of reassurance to people. So I hope you're not in the Jim Lovelock camp. I hope you're not in those sort of manic optimists who believe we've just got decades to go and don't worry. And I hope you're sort of somewhere in the point which says, boy, if we don't get moving very, very fast, we may well cross that threshold, see that tipping point emerge in our lifetime, where we lose the ability to command our own destiny. So, that was really the starting point for why I wrote this book, Capitalism as If the World Matters, because I wanted to, in my own mind, get to grips with the fact that we are totally dependent, therefore, on making these solutions work in a capitalist economy. It's got to be done in 10, 15, 20 years. I'm sure you would agree with me. There isn't any other political, macroeconomic system that's going to emerge in our midst suddenly, so we have to get it done through market-based capitalist systems. That's one hell of an ask. And that's really the conundrum that I tried to work out in that book. Okay, so that's one bit of my life as a sustainable development activist. The other bit is much more geared to what Fritz Schumacher splendidly described early on in his life as a sustainable development activist as the imperative for metaphysical reconstruction. Now, I like that phrase, metaphysical reconstruction, because it doesn't ask you to think about it through a particular prism, through a particular set of moral, ethical, spiritual, or religious precepts. It just challenges you to realize the limitations on bringing about a change process in society without some profound re-examination of the metaphysical basis for our society today, or bases for our society today. He wrote quite a lot of this, about this in his life, including his last book, The Wonderful Guide for the Perplexed, a book which I massively enjoyed because it just deepened my own personal sense of perplexity and confusion about ethical and spiritual issues. And I suppose the one thing that I can say with some certainty about my own spiritual journey is that it has been characterized for the last 35 years by absolutely chronic confusion at every single point of the journey. So I hope you're not going to work me over in too comprehensive and rigorous a way this afternoon as to the logical underpinning of my approach to these issues, because you might be just a touch disappointed at the end of the day. But Fritz Schumacher was very clear about this. He just said, unless we open up a different kind of discourse within society, one that goes beyond empiricism, beyond pragmatics, beyond the normality of what we do in our political lives as citizens, unless we open up a deeper discussion, it will actually be impossible to bring forward the kind of solutions to the way we live in the world today. And he was categorical about this. Although we now associate Fritz Schumacher with lots of very practical things to do with economics and technology and so on, actually he had this passionate belief that we needed to dig a lot deeper to find any solutions to those problems. He was also the one, of course, who said that we have to find a more transcendent story, a transcendent reality in people's lives, if we're going to be more effective in persuading them of the nature of the challenge and the change that we're now facing. Since him, of course, there have been many wonderful authors, writers, who have been immensely instrumental in my life, has helped me understand much more about this truth than would otherwise be the case. And I do, since I saw it on all your seats, I just want to mention Thomas Berry, who for me has been a great inspiration, an enormously important writer. His book, The Great Story, is one of the most astonishing encapsulations about what we need to do in a more cosmological sense about reinterpreting the role of humankind in the world today. Just a beautifully elegant, passionate account of rearticulating the role of humankind. So if you do have a chance to go to that event, I hope that you will, because it would be a terrifically important experience. It was also, of course, Fritz Schumacher who taught me in the early days about the power of interconnection, about the difficulties of seeing everything in terms of segmented, compartmentalized, discrete realities, that we choose to address each in its own right rather than to see as parts of a connected whole. Many of the reasons why we're struggling with the reality of living sustainably on the planet is because we still deconstruct the world into these very narrow silos of meaning, silos of scientific interpretation. And because of that, we're pretty much incapable of understanding some of the deeper truths about interconnection and, more importantly than that, interdependence. I just want to read one tiny little extract that I came across the other day to show this sense, the power of the notion of interconnection, which is a very powerful physical construct as well as a metaphysical construct. And this is from a book called The Spell of the Sensuous by an American writer called David Abram. Again, a wonderful book if you're casting around for any more books to read. It's probably there in Alan's bookshop, but I don't know. It is. I thought it might be. So this is from David Abram, The Spell of the Sensuous. The air unites our breathing bodies, not only with the under the ground, not only with the over the ground, and not only with the beyond the horizon of our lives today, but with the interior life of all that we perceive out there in the open field of the living present, with the grasses, with the leaves of the aspens and other trees, with all other creatures, with buzzing insects, with drifting clouds. When I think to myself of the reality of my daily life, I'm constantly astonished what the plants are breathing out day in, day out. We animals are breathing in. What we then breathe out, the plants breathe in. The air, we might say, is the soul of the visible landscape, a key to the forgotten presence of the earth itself. Now, many writers have touched on this notion of interconnectedness. Jim Lovelock, in his book about Gaia, has gone a lot further. And he's taken the concept of interconnectedness, which is this sense of what it is that links us to other life forms, into a deeper analysis of interdependence. And I suppose if there's one big, huge construct that makes sense for me when trying to interpret the spiritual mysteries of this world, it is this sense of absolute interdependence. Not just connectivity, not just links between us, but but total dependency at every level in each of the different systems of which we are a part. We as a species have no lived reality of interdependence. We still carry around in our mind the inheritance of hundreds of years' worth of Judeo-Christian Enlightenment thinking, which allows us to maintain the seductive illusion that we are somehow different and separate from what it is that makes up life on Earth. An American philosopher described this as the ontological assumption of separateness. Now just interrogate yourselves for a moment at this point. How comfortable are you with someone like me standing up and saying that one of the reasons why our civilization is in such deep difficulties is because our history has essentially inculcated in us an utterly fallacious notion of superiority and separateness that causes us to ignore that which makes life on Earth possible? And I am sorry about this, but the truth is that the history of Christianity tells us that for many, many centuries, the Christian Church exacerbated and worsened those fallacies and illusions about our separateness from and independence of the living systems on which we depend. We are paying a very, very high price today for that metaphysical ignorance. And as we rediscover the dependencies, which I'm just talking about, in a way, we have to rethink our whole process of interpreting our role in the world today. So the ontological assumption of separateness is something that lies at the heart of the difficulties that we face today. Now, I suppose it's fair to say that this issue about interdependence could be construed in a purely secular way. You could take it from the perspective of a good Earth system scientist looking at the carbon cycle, at the nitrogen cycle, the hydrological cycle, at the way in which all of these cycles are dependent on each other. And you could just say, well, there's nothing particularly mystifying or difficult about this. This is just our recently discovered knowledge of how these interlocking natural, physical, and geological systems combine together to optimize the conditions for life on Earth. So why do you want to make anything more of it than that? Why are you trying to turn it into a great set of new insights about reinterpreting the role of humankind, which sounds all very grand, but may after all be little more than vain glory in terms of the world that we live in today. So I'm aware of the fact that you can deal with all of these things at a completely secular level. Indeed, the reason why I told the story about Friends of the Earth was that was precisely what Friends of the Earth felt most comfortable doing. It didn't matter where the knowledge or the new insights came from, this was something that could be contained within a purely secular empiricist world. Now, for many people, that is not adequate. For many people, they find it important to tease out a deeper, more spiritual understanding of interdependence and interconnectedness than would otherwise be the case. Each person will arrive at their own set of spiritual understanding around that, and it would be wrong for me to try and assume that you would share one common approach to all of that. We will each have our own, I suspect, beacons of light and truth in coming to understand what that means. Often because of the books that I bought with Alan, I have a splendidly eclectic approach to this, and have learnt massively from all sorts of different people in all sorts of different faith and religious traditions. It has been for me a massively important personal resource in the life that I do. And when people ask me, 35 years on, as it were, how do you go on doing this stuff? What is it that allows you to get up in the morning and even still crack the occasional joke? The truth of it is, for me, I couldn't have done this without a sense of a very deep spiritual commitment to the process of change that I find myself involved in. So it is a deep personal issue. I wouldn't be what I am now if I hadn't been able to call on that deep spiritual resource. But I can't deny that it is also a very political issue for me. And here's where I want to get into some stuff that I hope will overlap, chime with what Tim was talking about this morning. Go back to Schumacher's concept of metaphysical reconstruction. What do you suppose he meant by that? Well, in his Guide for the Perplexed, he talks about three big areas where we need to reconstruct our understanding of the relationship between humankind, the cosmos, the living planet, and so on. The first of those, and the one that you would be most familiar with from a straight environmental perspective, the first of those is reconfiguring our relationship with the living world. This is a long, deep, and very rich debate that has gone on in the environment movement for many, many years. Do you take an instrumental approach to protecting the planet, an approach that says we need to look after the planet because that's the only way of looking after ourselves? Or do you take what is known as a more intrinsic value approach to the natural world? We need to look after it because we have a moral, spiritual, religious obligation to look after it in its own right, regardless of its value to us or not. This instrumental versus intrinsic worldview is what lies behind some of the biggest differences in the green movement today, although you don't often see them featured as such. So for me, it is impossible to imagine how today's stripped-down, narrow, instrumental environmentalism will ever get us to the point where we need to be, which is protecting and managing all of the resources and the life support systems on which we depend with such skill, insight, intelligence, that we really will create this sustainable future for 9 billion people. That kind of instrumental, rational approach to environmental protection is always too little, too late in terms of what it offers humankind today. So many religious and spiritual leaders have talked about the process of re-sacralizing the earth, bringing the sacred back into our understanding of what we owe the living planet and all life forms with which we share it. Moving from that dried up phrase, respect for nature, to something much more akin to reverence for nature. Personally, unless we begin to see that journey happening in very large part, in many parts of the world, I don't think conventional environmentalism has a hope in hell of dragging people back from the abyss that now confronts us. The second area that Schumacher talked about was the need for empathy at every point in our lives, when looking out at every other human being with whom we share this planet and every other life form. For him, of course, empathy was a very powerful social justice construct. He felt as deeply about some of the issues that you were touching on earlier as anyone has ever done. And empathy for him was a battle cry about creating a more just and equitable world. Well, again, I ask myself sometimes when I look at that wonderful outpouring of concern for other people in the world today, does it have within it the transformative power that will enable us to build a genuinely sustainable, compassionate world for 9 billion people by the middle of this century? I very much doubt it. And then lastly, and perhaps most importantly, Schumacher also said that the only opportunity we have to move people away from the kind of rampant consumerist materialism that now dominates our lives is by celebrating what he often called the power of enoughness. Now, this is not an elegant English word, okay? I'm an ex-English teacher, so the word enoughness doesn't really quite do it for me. But you can see what he's after here. There are many other words that capture that. Frugality, voluntary simplicity, modesty. There is much teaching in all the world's major faith systems that leads us to understand, to believe, that without that kind of frugality at the heart of our lives, we will constantly be betraying our true potentiality as an individual on this planet. I'm watching politicians today struggle with the power of rampant consumerism in the world today. They honestly are completely baffled as to how to bring people back from a sense in their own lives that their future depends entirely on access to yet more consumption, increased purchasing power, and all of those things that go with it. Will politicians ever come up with a sufficiently convincing antidote to the seductive appeal of consumerism? Well, Tim and I probably have different views on this. He may have given you one view this morning. For me, when I look at their inadequacy, their confusion, their paralysis, frankly, in the face of the power of consumerism, I don't think they have it within them to use political and economic resources to turn that whole thing around. So in all three of those things, seeing and feeling the world very differently, seeing and feeling the world of other people very differently from a more empathetic point of view, and seeing and feeling our own role in that world as citizens very differently, on all those three counts, it seems to me very difficult to imagine an entirely secular route to a sustainable world. Now, of course, saying that here in the UK is a little bit difficult. If you live practically anywhere else in the world, that would be blindingly obvious. Our world is still an intensely religious world. Out of the 6.4 billion people on that world today, at least 5.5 billion, depending on how you construct religious practice in China, at least 5.5 billion would officially be said to be adherents of or members of one faith or religious community or another. So it's an overwhelmingly religious world in which we live. Overwhelmingly religious. And yet what for me is so absolutely fascinating is that when we talk about constructing these enormous solutions to achieve a sustainable world for 9 billion people, I don't hear anybody talk about the role of the world's religions in making that journey work just a little bit more efficiently and effectively than would be the case otherwise. Well, not really. If we do ever hear about it, we often hear the things we don't want to hear about in terms of the fundamentalism, intolerance, and bigotry that is still there in all the world's major faith systems to such an extent that many people feel very turned off by them. I was astonished to be sent recently a summary of a conference organized by the Vatican with the support of the Holy Father himself, the Pope, organized by Cardinal Martino, who, for those who follow the politics of the Catholic Church today, will know that he is the primary fixer for our new Pope today, who organized this conference under the Pontifical Council to reconsider issues to do with global warming, paganism, and population reduction. And I'm just going to give you a quote from the final resume of this conference, just in case you still think that, you know, this sort of Christian Church, Church of England, or Catholicism has got it sorted okay, bound to be on the side of the angels, surely, when it comes to all of these things. Well, whew. Not quite. So here is Cardinal Martino in all his great glory. Man has an indisputable superiority within and over all the rest of creation, and in virtue of his being a person endowed with an immortal soul, cannot ever be held to be equal to other living beings, nor considered at any point to be a disturbing element in the natural ecological balance of the world today. The social doctrine of the Church must deal with many current forms of idolatry of nature, worship of nature, pagan idiosyncrasies, which lose sight of the superiority of man. Such ecologies often emerge in the debate on population and the relationship between population, paganism, and the environment. And then the conference went on basically to trash today's consensus on climate change, the scientific consensus, as having no proper validity. There's another quote here about how all this hysteria about anthropogenic causes of global warming have persuaded the collective imagination that CO2 is a polluter or a synonym of pollution. This is simply absurd. Our very life on Earth depends on CO2. It is thanks to CO2 that we're able to grow in the way that we do today. Gordon Bennett. So, whenever I'm advocating a slightly more spiritual approach to these matters, it is invariably the case that someone will say to me, "Have you lost your marbles, Jonathan? Have you looked at what the world's major faiths, religions, are doing out there?" And at that point you have to get into a complicated description about the difference between religion and spirituality and so on and so forth. And I wish it was genuinely different. I wish I could stand up and say, "I feel so proud about what is being done by Christians today in defense of God's earth." But I can't. I honestly can't. I look out there and I see an immensely troubled church, excessively and to me mystifyingly preoccupied with issues of human sexuality. A church which has spent 20 years working out that women are fully fledged human beings, and another 20 years, it seems, working out that all gay men and women are also fully fledged human beings in their own right. 20 years for each of these issues, precisely the 40 years when, if ever the church needed to be militant in defense of God's creation, that should have been the time. And my God, when people come to write the history of Christianity, assuming we're still able to write the history of Christianity in 40 to 50 years' time, this will be seen as one of the periods in church history which makes for the biggest indictment of leadership, collective failure, of any other point in history. Now, I know that's unfair. Many of my Christian friends at that point weigh in on me and say, "That's ridiculous, Jonathan. You're exaggerating. Don't you listen to the wonderful sermons of Rowan Williams, Richard Charters, the Bishop of London, who recently tried to point out that owning an SUV was, quote, symptomatic of sinfulness." He might just have simplified things and said, "You are a sinner," but no, that would be too easy. But I can't honestly point to much success in that area. So I haven't talked much about religion, because I actually don't think that our religion, the Christian religion, has a terribly great deal to offer at the moment in terms of what now needs to be done to come to the defense of planet Earth and its people. And I'm sorry if that's offensive. I struggle with that because I'd like it to be very different. So essentially, that's the end of what I want to say here. I'm in this really paradoxical position, speaking personally, where I know I couldn't do the work that I do without the spiritual practice that lies behind it. I know that we're going to need a deepening of those spiritual insights in order to get us to this more sustainable world that we all, I imagine, aspire after. And yet I look out on a religious scene that seems at every point to act as a block and impediment to these changed worldviews and behaviors that we really need. So as you can understand, I think I'm probably fully entitled to call myself terminally confused. Thank you.